You might make a start. Welcome to today's Parliamentary Library Lecture. My name's Liz Lucchetti and I'm the Assistant Secretary of the Library Collections and Databases Branch. The Parliamentary Library Lectures bring distinguished speakers to the Library to speak on significant topics of interest to Senators and Members and the work of Parliament. Today's lecture is titled Australian Crime Statistics, Context is Everything. There are perhaps few areas of public policy so prone to misunderstanding, misinterpretation and distortion as crime statistics. They frequently feature in newspaper headlines as the basis of latest crisis or panic. And yet, crime statistics also provide a very important tool for seeing the wider picture of crime types and trends and for assessing the best ways to deal with crime. Today's speaker will talk about how to understand crime statistics and use them effectively. Professor Tony Mackay is an Emeritus Professor in the Centre of Social Research and Methods at ANU and a former Director of the Australian Institute of Criminology. She established the first national monitoring program on drug use and crime in Australia and was a member of the Australian National Council on Drugs. Tony is one of the most highly qualified and experienced practitioners in Australia in this area, and I am delighted that she agreed to come to Parliament to speak today. Tony will speak for about 30 minutes. She's then happy to take some questions. Please join me in welcoming Tony Mackay.
Thanks very much, and 30 minutes might be difficult for me. As for those of you in the room who know me, I can talk underwater, so I'll try and skip over bits that probably are a bit technical. One of the things that I was asked to do was just come and talk to you about, really, about the official crime statistics. So I am going to get a little bit technical in some places, but it is about the context of understanding how those crime data are used and then how they're presented in various statistical reports, and as you stated, how they're then picked up by the media and by politicians as well to promote certain agendas. So one of the things that I want to do is to talk about those official statistics. I can't talk about all of them. They're very complex and technical, and there are quite a lot of different collections. So I will focus on primarily on victims and offenders, what we get from those official statistics, and then I want to move away a little bit from that and ask a policy question, like how much crime is drug related, and talk about whether those statistics can actually answer that question. So that's the sort of framework in which I'm going to operate in. Oops. So as has already been indicated, the statistics get generated in a very broad framework in terms of what is actually collected, what the decisions are about what's collected, how they're counted and how they're reported. And they're influenced by both our legal and social environment in which we work. So the legal environment sets up whether certain things are crimes and so on. But in our social environment, the wider community have a slightly different perception often of what's criminal behaviour. So, and the most obvious example of that is antisocial behaviour, where the community will regard that as criminal behaviour, but actually often it's not in the statutes as criminal behaviour. It will depend on what's involved in it. The other issue around our crime statistics is what practitioners need. And so that often drives as well the types of data that are collected and reported. And so practitioners like police will have different needs from, for example, the community, and they in turn will have different questions that they'll be asking from politicians, for example. The other thing that drives the kind of data is actually the research inquiry. So what researchers are interested in. And they drive a lot of the statistics that are put out because they're analysing, they're collecting, they're analysing, and they're reporting. And so the frameworks in which academics bring to their research will actually drive the kind of data and what's made of it. The other thing is that our environment is constantly changing. And it tends to be fairly slow and incremental by and large, that environment. But occasionally there are radical shifts. And so, for example, if you think about a radical shift was, for example, World War II, where there were massive movements of people. It generated post-World War II massive migration and so on. And so you have this real radical change that went on. You have marriage across classes, for example, that could occur in a way that couldn't occur before World War II. So you get these sort of momentous occasions in our environment. But by and large, our environment is pretty stable, and so we just get these sort of changes that go on. The other thing about the crime statistics, and any statistics, I would argue, particularly in the social arena, is you're dealing with probabilities, you're not dealing with absolutes or certainties, because the context matters. What you've collected and how you've collected it affects the data, and so on. And one of the things that I think we're very poor about is actually indicating the amount of error that sits around the data, and how we have to be very careful about it. The final thing I would just caution always is there's always exceptions to the rule. There's always that case that's different, that doesn't meet the broad general view of an event. And those are actually very important cases because they can often illustrate something that's hidden below what we're doing. And so we really need to understand and have be attuned to the case of one, which is highly illustrative. So I worked... had a period of time where I did work on nursing homes, which you might wonder how that relates to crime. Well, there's quite a lot of criminal activity in nursing homes, particularly if you're elderly and abused. And what we discovered there was that there could be cases of one event which might emerge, which were actually indicative of an underlying level of activity that was going on. So as a researcher in particular, one has to always be attuned to those cases. As I've sort of been trying to elicit to argue is that actually one of the key issues is what do we want to know? And the problem in crime is that there's an enormous number of different questions. So you come at the data from very different perspectives. You might want to focus on victims, you might want to focus on offenders, or you might want to focus on the offending behaviour itself. So you're interested in armed robberies and just what is the context in which armed robberies occurred, where do they occur, and so on. Sometimes you're interested in the methods, so you're interested in whether it's firearms. There's, you know, great interest always in the community about firearm-related homicide, for example. So you're interested in the method in which crime occurs. Sometimes victims and offenders are not actually, we think of them as individuals, but they can be organisations, for example, can be victims. We're also, sometimes we're not interested in the individual specific case, we're interested in, the pathway, so we're interested in offenders and their criminal history. That becomes incredibly complex to try and work your way through and to understand. Sometimes we're interested in victims who are repeat victims. That is, you know, incredibly important if we're looking at domestic violence, for example, and trying to understand that as an issue. So we're interested in the history and what were the early triggers that could have potentially been identified and intervention put in place. We're interested sometimes in whether the offending occurs multiple times in the same place. So is a place itself crime prone because it's not actually set up in a way which can mitigate criminal behaviour. So there's this huge number of questions and that makes it pretty challenging if you're trying to establish crime statistics. So where can you go if you want to try and answer those? Well, there's a plethora of places that actually collect data related to crime. The obvious ones we all think of are state and police territory, police forces, but the ATO, Centrelink, Australian military courts, for example, they all collect data on criminal behaviour. And then we move into civil proceedings. If you're interested, for example, in environmental crime and violations of planning laws locally and so on, then you would go to those sources for information. There is, of course, the Return Report on Government Services. So for those of you, if you've never looked at it, I highly recommend it. It's a wonderful resource that's very rarely used. It has data, for example, and it tries to use the data and try and make sense of the data that's collected by other agencies. there are a whole plethora of state-based research agencies which have had quite variable histories in terms of longevity. It's a very checkered history in this area of agencies being able to survive the winds of a change and controversy that emanates from crime statistics. And there's the ABS, which is largely the data that I'm going to initially focus on, but there's very limited access to that data. Then there's the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare. They collect data, for example, on juvenile detention and prisoner health records. And then there are self-report data. So many academics will do surveys, for example, and so on. So you can see you've got this huge range of data. And, of course, all of that is subject to the context of what the question that's being asked, why the data is being collected, how is it being collected, how is it being counted, and so on. So one of the real issues in trying to understand the data is to really understand the crime funnel. And essentially, when you, depending on where you look in the system, you will get very different numbers on your crime statistics. So, for example, in the community, not everyone reports crime. To police. In fact, in certain crime statistics, there's very high rates of underreporting, which I'll show you in a minute. So initially, you already have a massive drop-off in the rates appearing in the to police in terms of criminal activity. Then, of course, what happens is that the police make determinations, they do investigations and so on, they make decisions about whether they're going to proceed. They don't proceed with everything. They can also, they then also deal with the public prosecutions. The public prosecution will also make decisions. Is it a case they're likely to win? Will they kind of drop some of the charges because they want to just proceed with some charges? That immediately is going to affect your counts as well. So there's decisions that are made there. Then, of course, you go into the courts. Not everyone gets found guilty. And so then you're going to get different outcomes out of your court data in terms of what the profile of offending is. And, of course, not everyone gets a prison sentence. So if you looked at only the prisoner data, you'll get a very small subgroup of your total pool of people who are potentially engaged in criminal behaviour. So you can see that this is funnel, what we call the crime funnel that occurs. So you need to be very careful how you talk about crime, depending on which data source you're going to pick up. So if we think about that initial point I made, there's a whole range of behaviour out there. People are victims of crime, but they don't report to police. As a result of that, basically in the 1960s, in the United Kingdom, academics were very concerned about the official data coming out of police. They said it underreported the amount of crime in the community, and they began to do crime victim surveys. And so this has now become one of the primary sources of data on victims of crime in order to get a wider view and a wider understanding. The other advantage of crime victim surveys is that they actually allow you to ask more questions. So you can actually begin to understand more about the context of how the event happened. In Australia, we started with the crime and safety surveys in 1999, and they were large-scale surveys. By that I mean they did have quite an extensive questionnaire that they asked, and they ran through to 2015. They weren't annual, they were every 3 to 4 years or so, and they were very slow in coming out because they all had to be processed and it took a long time and so on. And that was very problematic because what you had was your law and order campaigns going on in the political process, and you had data which wasn't current to inform that debate. And so that was the real problem. The other issue as a researcher was that we couldn't get our hands on it to analyse it because it wasn't released. Most of it, most often, I think there was one that was released as a unit record file because it was collected by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. And so you couldn't do analysis on the data. Basically, then there was a lot of push to try and move and change that, to try and get some indicators on an annual, at least on an annual basis, from victims. And so in 08, 09, we moved to what are called the crime victimisation surveys, and they are very limited, they're very focused on the sort of major crime categories, and they're relatively large sample size, they're on the back of the labour force survey, and they're released on an annual basis. So the idea of that was to try and build. And that time series, as I said, has been starting since 08, 09. So we're now starting to get a serious time series on that data. But it is very limited. It is just a count of victims of major criminal offences. And in that, there's a number of questions which are about you as a personal victim and you as the household. Because that's the other thing to think about. If you're going to ask the crime victim survey, you've got to distinguish between whether you're the personal victim or whether the household's the victim. So the break and enter is the household. If you've been assaulted in your home, you're the victim. So there's a difference in that, and you need to understand that. So basically, the most recent, I've got some data up there, won't go into it, gives you an idea of the proportions of people who are saying that they've been personally victims of crime in the last 12 months. So those are the crime victim surveys that we can look at. And one of the things they ask is, do you report to police? And this is this is consistent. It's consistent with victim surveys generally that are done by academics, it's consistent internationally, and so on. So what you find is the top line, which is the purple line, that's motor vehicle theft. And you can see there that basically around 90% of that crime is reported to police. At the bottom, we look on the red line, it's sexual assault, and it's right down there, around 30% is reported to police. And so the question is, well, what's the context? Why is it that we get very high rates of reporting on motor vehicle theft? We kind of know the answer on sexual assault, right? But why high rates? Well, the simple reason is you can't get your insurance payout if you don't report to the police. You've got to have that number. So it's, you know, that's what drives the reporting rates. So again, as I say, understanding why people report, why they don't report, is very important for then interpreting the context of the later data on the volume of crime of motor vehicle thefts and the police data. Of course it's very high, because everybody reports. And of course sexual assault's relatively very low, because a lot of people don't report. So that is why the crime victim surveys are very important if you're looking at victims. But of course, it's a victimisation survey, so it is always subject to some error, even though it's a very large or relatively large survey that's done in the Australian context, it still has some error around it. So basically, that's your crime victim data. Let's assume someone's reported the crime, they go to the police and report the crime. There's then a whole process that occurs within police agencies about how they actually record the crime in the system. This is an example from quite a long time ago where I was involved in a review of the Victoria Police statistics. And basically what happens in the Victorian case is that basically the matter comes to the attention of the police. The other thing to remember is what comes to the attention of the police is, but largely comes from the community, right? Who rings up the police? Offenders don't tend to ring the police and tell them that they've just committed a crime. So you get, again, you're going to get these particular context which is driving the reporting requirements. So the matter comes to the attention of the police. The police then make a decision about whether or not they're going to record. They're actually making decisions about that. They don't record everything into the system because, in fact, we know from research that you know, up to, I think it's 40 or 50% of police time doesn't result in a crime report. I mean, they're very enormously important in the community because they play this community role where they go and help little old ladies like me whose cat's got caught up in the tree. Who do you ring? You ring the police. And they come. They're a 24/7 service. One of the few left to do 24/7 service. So they do all sorts of things in the community. They're out and about, they're collecting intelligence, They're observing things. They're sitting on the road waiting for you to come by speeding so they can give you a speeding ticket. You know, they're doing all sorts of things. So a large amount of their time actually doesn't result in a police recording in the system. Now, as part of this, they use both their discretion and the evidence that they see in front of them to decide. And I'm going to come back to this notion of evidence in a minute, because it's actually very important to understanding crime statistics, particularly in the Australian context, where our crime data, a lot of it comes from state-based police agencies, and they're all different, and they all do different things, by and large. So they put it into the system. There's then a whole lot of quality controls that go on, administrative people who look over it to try and make sure that it's all correct. Then it gets entered into their database, and then there's a whole lot of counting rules that occur, because actually the recording of crime is actually quite complex. The counting rules get applied, and then they're produced. The police produce their data, and the ABS produce their data. They use the same data source. They get often two different sets of data because they apply different counting rules in there. So let's just have a look at why you would end up with different data. Well, basically, this is an example which we used in the report, where you have an armed robbery. You've got two offenders. Both of them had unlicensed firearms, and they assaulted two bank staff. So you've got one incident, right? But you've got all this complexity in there about what actually happened in the incident and what are you going to record and how are you going to record it. So there's a leak form generated. There's an incident form then as a result of it being generated. They said, yes, it's a crime, we'll record it. They generate the incident form. Then there's a whole lot of sub-incidences that get recorded in the system. You get the robbery, the bank is a victim because it's a robbery against the bank. Two of the tellers were assaulted. If there hadn't been any assault on the tellers wouldn't be counted as victims. But there were two assaults in this case, so you get two assaults being recorded. And the two offenders had unlicensed firearms. So they also, there's two firearms incidences that are recorded. So you imagine this huge database, got all this information in it, it's massive, right? And then you've got to make decisions about what you're going to pull out, what you're going to record, and so on.
Sorry, can I just ask, in that one where the tellers weren't assaulted, but they may have been traumatised, is that not a crime?
No. Okay. That'll be the bank will have to deal with that, yeah. And provide support, but no.
Okay.
No. So unless there's an actual crime, it won't get recorded. Yeah. So that gives you an idea, and that's just one case. So if you think of an offender, if you're looking at offenders and their criminal history, how complicated that becomes in terms of trying to understand that. So I've talked a bit about the counting. I've mentioned the counting rules, and basically the counting rules, there's not one counting rule. There are multiple counting rules, depending on what the incident is, what the reporting behaviour is of victims, and so on. So if you've got a person who's been a victim of offences multiple times in the same incident, right? The victim's only counted once. Right? So maybe they're assaulted, sexually assaulted, property stolen from them, and so on and so forth. The victim, they report, it's one incident, it's only reported by the victim as at the one time, it gets recorded once. However, if the victim was assaulted multiple times and at different times throughout the year, the same offender, let's say, they report at different times, they get counted each time to get a different outcome. So the counting rules that apply and how it's put into the system and how it's drawn out of the system are really important. So I won't go on about the counting rules, but that's just to give you an idea of how that context of what's generated out of the system really matters. The other thing that happens is, and this is taken directly from the Australian Bureau of Statistics and their recorded crime data, is Within the counting rules, there are more counting rules. So what happens is you've got the victim in this case. They've had the police lay charges. They lay a charge of serious assault resulting in injury and serious assault not resulting in injury. They're two different charges. So there are two different charges in the system, but when we come to do the official statistics, we use the what are called the ANZOC classifications, the Australian and New Zealand Standard Offence classifications, and we take the highest code in that classification. So that classification is O2, and within it there's an O211 and O212, and what happens is that we take the highest one in the code. And that's the one that gets counted in the official statistics, not both of them. And in terms of victims, there's one assault that goes on. And so we can see also with the sexual assault, there's a number of charges can be laid around the sexual assault, but only one, the highest one, gets counted in the official reporting statistics. So that's a visualisation of those counting rules. And there's a whole lot of other things.
Sorry, do the same rules occur if... like a home invasion happens and there's two people who assault the one person, two different offenders?
So there'll be one victim if it's a victim count. If it's an offender count, there'll be two offender counts. So depending on whether you're looking at victims or whether you're looking at offenders, you'll get a different count.
Okay, so the victim isn't counted twice, for example, if then...
Okay. If you were counting offenders, would that same rule apply for like people that were a party to an offence? So... a sexual assault, but someone else was charged as like.
They'd be counted as a separate. Yeah.
Who determines the hierarchy?
It's a classification code. So again, the administrators who are managing the system, they apply codes according to the rules, and the ABS sends out all these rules, which is pretty hard because you're dealing with huge numbers of different potential possibilities, but they make a decision, they assign that code, and then basically the computer is running over it and it takes the number, signs the highest count, and so on. So
if I'm in a robbery and someone pushes me against the wall and I sort of hurt my shoulder, that's an assault. But I might find that uncomfortable. You know. But if I'm then threatened, then I'm going to be killed with a knife at my throat. Which is the higher?
Probably the if you're being threatened with
I'm not hurt. I'm just threatened.
I don't know. They're two charges, but it sounds to me like they're in the same category. And the question is, which one you take is the higher? They're both aggravated assault, by the sound of it. The one's a physical push, and the other's the use of a weapon.
I'm not physically hurt. I'm just threatened.
But it takes into account what the circumstances. So if there's a weapon involved, that will be taken into account. So in the classification, so the circumstances matter as well in that case. So the other issue that we have is, and this is one of my increasingly pet little issues, is that we actually publish only a very limited amount of the data that goes into the public arena. So we publish the things that we would consider to be major crimes: homicide, sexual assault, robbery, unlawful entry with intent, which is actually break and enter. It was a compromise decision to call it that because none of the jurisdictions all fought over what it should be called. Kidnapping and abduction, blackmail, extortion, motor vehicle theft and other theft. Those are the major crimes that we publish in our official statistics. It's a whole lot of crime not reported. Out in the official statistics. So, for example, white-collar crime, you don't get it from the official crime statistics. There is the multi-purpose household survey that has some questions in it, but it's taken from a survey. It's not taken from the official recorded crime by police. And there's, of course, there's been the personal fraud survey. What about cybercrime? The other thing that's happening in our society is that what's defined as a crime changes over time. So we would have, for example, if we went back 30 years ago, we would find, for example, homosexuality is a crime. It's not a crime today. Our laws are different, our social context is different, and so on. Abortion varies across jurisdictions. Cyberbullying now is emerging now as an issue. We're now moving to legislate potentially to make it a criminal activity. So our laws are changing, but our official crime statistics really, in my view, reflect a bit of the past. As a result, the collections need to be constantly reviewed and updated. The other thing, environmental crime, issues like that, for example, where do we go? We'd have to go, if we want to find anything about that, we're going to have to go to planning and environment, and good luck trying to find that out. And of course, the other issue is the amount, how many of you have been the victim of your credit card being used? And did you report it to the police? And did the bank report it to the police? No. So there's a whole range of new activity. The underlying behaviour is the same. It's committing a fraud, but now it's in a different context. It's able to be done much more easily. It's occurring much more often, but we have very little data on it. So we've got this argument that goes on that crime is in decline, but crime is in decline for the categories we're currently looking at and reporting on. Maybe it's not in decline if we actually looked at the way in which behaviour is changing and what's going on in our society. Okay, so I've got a whole lot of stuff in here about offenders, the federal system, how difficult it is to collate this data and work across jurisdictions and so on. One thing I mentioned was about discretion and why it's so important in the police system. So I'm just going to quickly go through this. You'll have a copy of this so you can have a look at it yourself. So what happened in the Australian context was that there was a huge stoush occurred, largely between Victoria and New South Wales, because the ABS was producing the data, the official data, taken out of the police records on assaults. And what it showed was that New South Wales had much higher rates of assault than Victoria. Needless to say, the New South Welshman said that's not the case. The Victorians said we're fantastic, we're much better at controlling crime and so on. Everyone takes the glory where they can get it. But what happened was that there are actually different processes at work in what gets counted into the system. And in Victoria, for assaults, that notion that I talked about, the evidence, really matters. So in Victoria, if the police officer determines that there's not enough evidence to know that an assault actually occurred, what were the facts of the case, then they don't record in the system. So, and the other, in New South Wales, if the police officer's called, someone says I was assaulted, makes an allegation, that will get recorded into the system. So there's what we call a difference between an evidentiary-based system and a prima facie-based system. So this actually affects your crime counts. And this also occurred in the UK also. They had, in different policing counties, they had different processes involved in what was recorded. And, of course, those jurisdictions that used an evidence-based approach looked really great on their crime statistics, and then the Home Office got involved. The crime rates went up dramatically as they tried to push in a consistent recording and reporting mechanism. So there's a real issue in terms of the type of system that's collected. And in the Victorian case, what happened was the ABS said, well, we're not going to continue to produce crime statistics. They also stopped producing the sexual assault data as a consequence. For a year or two, and then some of us said, well, why is that happening? You're talking about assault, sexual assault for different things. So sexual assault continued to be reported after, I think, about 2 years. Damien might recall what the time frame was. But assaults to this day are only reported at jurisdictional level, and they don't produce the data for... for Victoria and also for Queensland. This is just an example from the report where we actually did a survey and we actually asked police, we gave them scenarios and asked them about whether they would record it as a crime or not. And you can see the black is they would record, the white is that they wouldn't record. And you can see, depending on the scenario, you get very different results. You need to look at the actual scenarios to look at what's going on. But largely, this one at the number six at the end is largely about an assault. So does it matter? Yeah, it sure matters. So in 2010, down here, this was the Australian Institute of Criminology takes the official crime statistics, produces its report, and it recorded that across Australia there was 171,000 approximately assaults going on. And then when the ABS said, well, you can't do this because Victoria underreports, so we're not going to produce data, suddenly the assault data dropped by a massive amount because there's a lot of assaults. It's a large driver of your crime rate. And so this really matters. And this issue of the recording still hasn't been resolved in terms of how the data is collected. And there's been a lot of research which shows that the model, the better model, is actually the evidentiary, the prima facie model, not the evidentiary model, because the evidentiary model means that you're not collecting as much information as you would. And if you think about police not just as agencies to collect data for people like me to analyse, actually they have a job to do, and that's to investigate crime, you would think they would want to collect as much intelligence as they can. So their systems are not all about their administrative systems. They're not just for the purposes of research. They're actually primarily for the purposes of evidence of investigation, intelligence, and preemptive policing. So, and to this day, you might think, oh, well, this was in 2002. Oh, it's all changed. Well, no, this was the 2014 vision paper where the Victoria Police actually said that they there are issues, but also there are issues across Australia where we don't have a national recording system, a national intelligence sharing system, which then could allow very detailed work to go on. I just want to end on this policy question of how much crime is drug-related, and this is really important because we're in the world of big data, right? All those administrative systems got all this data and they can answer all the questions. And the reality is that they can't answer all the questions. We will never get away from needing to do specific context-based studies which allow us to understand what's going on. And the classic is how much crime is drug-related. You can't, from the official statistics, determine that. You can determine the number of people who are charged with a drug offence, but the proportion who commit property crimes that are committing the crime because they need money to fund their drug habit, don't know. The number of crimes, assaults that are being driven because someone is intoxicated on alcohol or on ice, don't know. Can't get it from the official statistics. And you're probably never going to get it from the official statistics because, as I said, the people who are recording, they have a job to do. Their job is to get out and police, or their job is to manage the courts. Their job isn't to collect data to help inform necessarily our research. So you're going to need these context-specific studies in order to be able to do this. And yet, for that, of course, you need to go back to criminological theory. So you can't answer the question in terms of the administrative data. It's useful. It can tell you things. It can particularly tell you things about process and volume of what's going on a day-to-day basis in activity in those institutions. But it's not going to tell you a lot about the why question. Why are people doing the things they do? And if you're interested in crime prevention, you're interested also in the why question, not just on the volume or the prevalence, but why are people doing the things? And for that, you have to go back to the good old surveys and so on. And so you would want to do a survey of offenders to try and work out what's going on. And even there, it's still complex. You know, what's the causation? Why are they doing it? How do you measure dependency in surveys? You know, who is dependent? Who was dependent, but who was intoxicated at the time, but they're not necessarily dependent. They're very different issues about in terms of trying to to look at things. So, and of course you've got the usual issues with self-report data. You've got validity and reliability issues. Are people telling you the truth and so on? So, crime stats, as we started with, highly contested area. It's very political. There are a whole lot of questions that I would argue around the crime stats. We have very limited data. It's amazing that we only started collecting national statistics in 1999. There's a long way to go. By not, in my view, is by not releasing data, not putting out in the public arena, you don't have scrutiny of that data, and therefore that data remains behind closed doors. You don't get improvements, so you'll hear people say, we can't release the data, it's very dirty in the systems, which it is, but you're not going to get anyone who's going to take interest in cleaning it up if people are not working with it and pointing out where those issues actually are. So my overall conclusions is I believe in the administrative data. I think it's very important. I think there needs to be more engagement with it. There needs to be more of it made available. We need to be able to access it. We need to realise that the statistics are different from operational intelligence data. They're used for very different purposes, even though they may use the same source, primary source, to extract information from. And we need to be careful of what we call ecological fallacy or the macro-micro problem. Just because we find correlations at the aggregated level doesn't mean that that applies to every individual. And so we need to be always careful about that. So big data's here, it's important, but it won't answer all the questions. And I'll finish there.
Okay, great. Thank you, Tony. That was... Time for questions. So does anybody... Yes?
It might be a bit too much of a specialised question, but you mentioned you did some work in aged care and elder abuse. With the Oakton incident that happened in South Australia, do you think those statistics there, do you think they're an accurate reflection of an overall trend that is occurring and possibly on the rise, or do you think that's just one particular incident of, like, gross abuse?
I think it's like sexual assault. It's a significant underreporting.
Yeah.
It's also very hard for police to prosecute because often you're dealing with people who have dementia, yeah. They can't recall, there are no witnesses. You know, it has all the problems that we have with, in a legal sense, trying to prosecute cases. The other issue, too, you have is it's a very... It's a very emotional space because you've got families, the families, and you've got government officials who are going in doing the inspections. No one wants to close a nursing home because what do you do? Where do you put the residents? Right? It's one of those wicked policy questions in lots of ways. So the family, in a way, kind of, oh, we can't complain, can't say anything. You know, mum's got bruises, but gee, you know, maybe she did fall over. And what will we do? Where will we take her? Where will we put her if we're going to take her out? So it becomes, it's a really complicated area, but I think it's massively underreported. And the health department released some data, I think about 6 or 8 months ago, on the number of assaults reported to them, and it was very large. And that's not occurring in the official statistics.
Okay.
It was large.
How does it compare to sexual assault in terms of how underreported it is?
It's hard to ask because, you could, as I said, you've got all these people who are not able to report because they have dementia and so on.
Yeah.
So you'd have to rely on families. And I think there's work going on at the moment. Health have commissioned a large-scale study to try and get to... try and work out how you might measure,
yeah.
Try to get some measure, because if you can't count things in one way or another, then it's very hard to put in place policies to respond to it.
I know that's the situation we were in.
Yeah.
Like, we're almost certain my grandmother was being abused, but you don't want to make that accusation without solid evidence, and so nothing happened in the end. But.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, you come along to Parliament today, and I'm just wondering what you might want from politicians in this area. But also, you haven't really mentioned the media at all, and I mean, they report on all these things in a very dramatic way. And my feeling is that people don't really understand statistics anyway. I'm just wondering what
So there's a couple of things I really like. I like, I of course like a national agency created for this and collate all the national statistics on crime. But aside from that, which is never going to happen, what I think is to push for more access to data for researchers. That's one thing. The other thing is to increase the collection and look at the collection, not to do away with the collection as it is, like the homicide data and the armed robbery. These are still very serious offences. We need to know about them. But to actually look at what's emerging as the new crimes, in a sense, and collecting them. The other thing is to do things, innovative things. Like we set up, or the government set up, and I think the parliamentary librarian, Diane Herriot, was involved in setting up the National Crime Car Prevention Agency. Car Theft Prevention Agency.
Motor Vehicle Theft
yes.
Reduction
Council. Yeah, and it's really...
it's an inquiry into it at the moment.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. And if you look at that, that was working with industry. So if you think about the banks and financial institutions, any financial institution that issues credit cards, a lot of credit card fraud going on. It's not getting recorded, not being... We've got no sense of the scale of the problem, right? We don't report it because when it happens, the financial institution covers our losses. So we don't bother going to the police. They don't go to the police because it could be, you know, imagine what the headlines would be talking of the media if you actually knew the volume that was going on. So I think working innovatively with industry to set up reporting and collecting and dissemination, because I think it's important. The public, we live in theory in an open and transparent society, and that is part of that, is releasing our data to so the wider community can get better informed. So doing that, I think, is another key thing that needs to happen for the 21st century.
I think Rob sort of asked the same question I was. We use crime stats all the time, and we have major problems with domestic and family violence stats that are not disaggregated by the state governments, the state police services.
Yeah.
And the other one is guns. Mm. Even just the number of
firearms
that are legally licensed.
Yeah.
you know, we ring each state department and ask them. And some are really helpful, and sometimes it just seems to be who you get on the phone, but that's just me having a binge. But what do you think are the chances of us ending up getting that sort of data?
I think it's a really
hard. It's nationally useful.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's really hard because you've got states and territories, right? And they, of course, are at the coalface of the law and order debates, mm-hmm. right? And so they, of course, are concerned that they don't want, like I mentioned about the assault data, they don't want to be seen as the state with the highest rates of whatever it is. And so that makes it very, very hard. And that makes it very hard for the statistical, the ABS, to try and get recording. So firearms, I know well, we established firearms monitoring at the Australian Institute of Criminology when I was there, and it was a constant problem. They now no longer do it. I think the Australian Crime Intelligence agency is supposed to be doing it, but I don't think a lot comes out. I may be wrong on that. Happy to be corrected. Be delighted to be corrected. And so you've got this problem, and you have this problem where the stats are not where. Well, sort of talked about a central agency. You know, you would think the Australian Institute of Criminology would be the agency, but it was never established with the authority to require data to be provided to it. And to enable it to be like that. Whereas if you look in New South Wales, Boxer, which is its equivalent, it has online access to the police systems. And so it can do the research which ought to be happening also at the national level. So you have no, you have in a sense no national agency that does it. Now in theory, setting up a national intelligence body should do that. But my worry about that is always, you know, that is not necessarily going to produce the public statistics, I mean, because of all of the politics that sit around that. And so that's why I think an independent agency needs to have authority of it. And I think that you, at the moment what's happened is that different agencies have responsibility for different bits. And that stops then really serious research looking at the holistic picture. So you've got to go here for this bit and here for that bit and so on. And I don't think that's a sophisticated system for the 21st century.
It also is an excuse for not doing it.
That's right. Yeah. And they all have different rules about access. And
thanks very much for this really interesting presentation. I wanted to ask about the need to count things. And you said, you know, we have to count them so we can come up with a policy of them. How do you get out of the almost the spiral towards counting and counting and counting, and we get to be data and still counting, 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 particularly in relation to a point you made at the beginning about the case of one, you know, and how these might, you know, may tend to be dismissed as outliers when we start counting and counting and counting. But then you've got, you know, some people would say, well, that's just a sample bias. And you said, you know, there is a real value in, you know, a sample of one or a case of one, which can point to hidden things. So how do you find them when the compulsion is to count, 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 because that's how we understand that you find something?
So on the count, 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 the reason why I think we have too much, at one level we have too much information. And the reason we have too much information is that the primary data sources, a lot of people can't access them. So what they do is they go and do their own counting. Right. So you get replication, and often poor replication, of systems that already exist. So if you made your systems more readily available, that would reduce the amount of counting, right? So, and you get agreement as well. You get agreement on what's in them, agreement on the counting rules, agreement on a process where you're updating them, so you do account for new crimes, you're not stuck in the past all the time, and so on. So that would reduce the volume of counting. A lot of academics go out and do these surveys because they can't get access to the primary data. So they say, well, I haven't got any choice, I'm really interested in this problem, I'm going to have to collect my own data. That's actually, you know, it's a waste of government money given we don't have a lot. And so that's going on. That then frees up the space, I think, for the looking at the individual cases. And there you have to have a body of academics who are interested in different things from the people who count. I'm interested in the counting. That's what really interests me. That's my background. I worked on the nursing home with a bunch of people, some of whom are really interested in the case study of one. And so that's where you get the multidisciplinary teams in the research. And that's where I think that's the only way I can see that you get over the problem of being too counting focused and looking at it. So you have academics and researchers who suddenly their interest is sparked by something that occurs, or they wake up in the middle of the night with a bright idea and they say, gee, this is really interesting, I'm going to go and look at this. So I don't think there's any easy answer, multidisciplinary teams. I think less volume, less money being spent on small-scale surveys, which are not much good, really, if I'm honest, if you looked at a lot of them, shifting that money to improve our standard collections, about making them available. If you can't get access to them, you're going to collect data one way or another, and then you get more poor counting.
There seems to be this trend away from offences and infractions being criminal to being civil, and particularly sort of civil and regulatory actions, yeah. And like enforceable undertakings that don't result from a conviction. And I know, for example, in the electoral sphere, a lot of the government's been progressively moving all the criminal electoral offences to civil offences.
Yeah.
Am I right in that that's a broader trend, or am I just seeing a bit of confirmation bias? And what's the sort of impact of that on our understanding of crime?
I completely agree. So we've built this, and the idea was a good idea in the sense of it was meant to bring about a kind of justice quicker, right? Justice delayed is justice denied, in a sense. And so these tribunals have been established all over the place, and their remit has got wider and wider as well. And so we're getting huge amounts, I think, going through there. And so the civil matters are really important, and the ABS has very little on civil matters. It's mainly all focused on criminal matters, but civil this move to using civil courts, however they're defined, administrative appeals tribunal and so on, has grown massively. And again, there's very little reporting coming out in terms of what's involved there. And that's where, if you had a proper national agency which had a remit across all of these activities, you'd be able to find out whether our confirmation bias is confirmed or whether we're wrong in that. But yeah, I think it is a big issue for crime stats. Yeah.
Did you have that?
Yeah, I just had a quick question. Just with the firearms, did you say that state police are reluctant to give you the statistics about legally owned firearms? What's the incentive in that? I can understand them not wanting to report like levels of crime to lower their figures, but what's the incentive to not report, like give you the figures for legal firearms?
We don't know.
Oh, okay.
It's just it's always been a long term problem in this space to get the firearms data. Firstly, it's a problem in the recording. If you actually go into the systems, the recording hasn't been great. Over time, one would hope all this would be resolved with technology, right? But even then, it probably won't be. So it's a problem with what's in the system. They don't want to release data because their data's dirty, right? And then they'll be held to account for it. So you get that kind of thing. You get exactly what you said, and that is it just happens on the day you hit the person who decides they don't like you or you're from the feds and we're not going to give you anything. So you get that going on. So there's a whole range of reasons. I don't think it's a conspiracy.
It just didn't make a lot of sense to me.
But it happens in so many areas. It's not just in firearms. That's the problem. And I think the health people have moved further, but they also have similar problems, I suspect, if you looked at them in terms of what gets recorded nationally. It's a long haul for the Australian Institute of Human Welfare, I think, to get a new collection up and to get everyone to agree and to agree on counting roles and release of data to the Commonwealth from the states and territories. So, it's a real challenge, I think. It's one of the many costs to having a state and a federal system. Mm. Of course, the plus of a federal system is you can allow natural experiments to occur at state level. You were going to ask me a question.
So please join me in thanking Professor Tony.
When I was at the AEC, a good friend of mine was in charge of the National Police No Longer Run program. And so through her, I got to know some of the people that she worked with. And there was a guy who worked as a client commissioner.